The poinsettia is everywhere this time of year. It's beautiful, but where did this plant come from and how did it become such an important symbol of Christmas? This hour, we'll find out. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day. Chris Curry, Assistant Professor of Horticulture at Iowa State University, will be here. I'll talk with him about the history and transformation of the poinsettia. ISU Extension Horticulturist Richard Giron will also be here. We want to hear about your favorite gardening-related holiday gifts. We'll listen to some plant-inspired music, and Richard and Chris will answer your questions. Join the conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and the poinsettia is as much a symbol of Christmas as the Christmas tree. This hour, we're going to talk about the history and transformation of this festive plant. Chris Curry is here. He's an assistant professor of horticulture at Iowa State University. Hello, Chris.
Hi, Charity. How are you doing?
Good. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
And Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Giron is also here. Hello, Richard.
Good morning.
And of course, we'll be getting to your questions as the hour goes on. We also want to hear about your favorite gardening-related holiday gifts that you've received over the years. You can send us an email at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org or tweet us at IPRTalk. We'll also be listening to some plant-inspired music as the hour goes on as well, but we're going to start, again, with the poinsettia. And Chris, you've done quite a bit of research into the history of this plant, haven't you?
Yeah, I had some opportunity to look into the past of the poinsettia when I was at Purdue University, and it's a pretty important floriculture crop in the greenhouse industry, and that's my specialty as a faculty member, so it's good to know where we've come from.
All right. So first of all, where did this plant originate?
It's native to southern Mexico and northern Guatemala.
Okay. And we know that, of course, we get these brilliant colors because of the shorter period of light in the wintertime. So that was just something that was happening naturally in the winter months. We would see these vibrant colors in nature.
Yeah. What happens is that certain plants will try and time their flowering for certain times of year. And what that's the purpose of that is to try and synchronize flowering with perhaps the pollinator of the flower, because the whole purpose of flowering is to produce seeds, hopefully, and be fruitful and multiply. And so a lot of times plants will synchronize flowering with the length of the day because that's a very reliable indicator of the time of year. So you can think about that unseasonably warm weather we had a few weeks ago versus some of those unseasonably cold days in April. Sometimes the temperature isn't always a good indicator of the time of year, and so day length can be a really good time to synchronize flowering with a specific pollinator. And so presumably, poinsettia would have a pollinator that is active in the wintertime.
And there are a lot of stories told, I guess, in horticultural circles about the history of this plant. Some people believe that it was a royal plant of the Aztecs. What do we know about that history?
Well, it was it was used by the Aztecs for wintertime rituals, again, because it formed these very colorful bracts or modified leaves in the wintertime. And so what happened is these Aztec leaders would have thousands of plants brought to them in the wintertime for celebration. What happened then is we had the Spanish conquest, and once Catholicism came into the picture, the Spanish friars started to use the poinsettia to celebrate Christmas time.
Okay, so this was something that was used to celebrate before Christmas became part of the culture.
Yep.
All right, now let's talk about where the plant got its name, at least the name that we use, because obviously it wasn't called the poinsettia then.
No, the first scientific name, actually, I'm going to use a little bit of Latin here.
Right.
My wife always says that I sound smarter when I use Latin, so I'm going to try my best. Euphorbia pulcherrima. And Euphorbia is a real large plant family. You might know the crown of thorns,
mm-hmm,
or the spurge. It's a garden perennial. They're not normally very showy plants, but since the poinsettia is quite showy, pulcherrima means beautiful. So this is one of the most beautiful euphorbias. But we don't talk in scientific names. We use common names. And some of the first common names were Mexican flame flower or the painted leaf.
All right.
But those didn't really have a great ring to them.
No, but they're very descriptive.
Yeah, and it works quite well. The name that we use, poinsettia, is actually to honor the first minister to Mexico from the United States. And what the minister position was the predecessor to the ambassador. And Andrew Jackson was actually appointed as the first minister to Mexico, but he didn't go. Instead, Joel Robert Poinsett from South Carolina was sent down there. And he was a botanical enthusiast and plant lover, and so this plant is named after him, the poinsettia.
All right, and for a long time, people were telling stories that he was the one who, you know, saw this flower, saw this plant, and sent samples to the United States. Apparently, that's not true.
No, it's a great sounding story,
yeah.
And I don't want to rob anyone from being able to tell that, but it's not very clear that he actually had much to do with getting the plant into the United States. When you go back and look in some historical records, what we do find is that seeds and some plants were sent up from Mexico to Philadelphia. And so that's a link that we do have well established, but it's not known who sent these plants. In fact, it's suspected that it was not Poinsett. But since he was involved with the Academy of Natural Sciences in Philadelphia, people started to make this assumption. However, a letter from one of Poinsett's friends recalled or stated that they were quite disappointed that he had not sent any showy flowers. Whereas some catalogs from these seed shipments from another individual from Mexico did talk about this showy red perennial. And while it doesn't say poinsettia or Euphorbia pulcherrima explicitly, it's thought that that is probably the poinsettia.
Okay. So he probably had nothing to do with sending it to the United States. But there is some controversy about this plant and controversy. In fact, Mexican growers believe that Poinsett did something to prevent them from benefiting from the propagation of this plant?
Yeah, they had thought that he had patented the plant. And so this, again, is also not true. And while he was involved with some treaties, it had nothing to do with patenting a plant. And so that is that's not true at all. But the term poinsettismo is still used in Mexico to express arrogance or high-handedness. And that's in part because of this myth that they thought the poinsettia had been patented, as well as Poinsett got involved in the politics in Mexico and would favor one party over another. So he got a little bit more involved than perhaps.
Okay, so maybe that's a deserved. It's possible that that's a deserved moniker.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, I thought that was so interesting that the plant was named after him, although he didn't bring it to the United States, and that he's still cursed with regard to this plant, although he had nothing to do with patenting this plant. But was there some sort of a problem with growers in Mexico who were cultivating what we call poinsettias not being able to capitalize on this?
No, that is not true.
Okay,
now,
it's just a myth.
Yeah, it is a myth. Now we do have patented varieties under the plant patent protection, but historically, no, that has not been a problem. It's
all
just
right.
a perceived myth.
So, all right, we know that these seeds made their way to Philadelphia, but how did the poinsettia become popular in the United States?
Well, so that's an interesting story. It goes back to the family called the Ecke family, and they're really the cornerstone or backbone of the poinsettia industry. And what happened is Albert Ecke and his family were Germans, and they were traveling to Fiji. But en route to Fiji, they stopped in California, and they were really taken aback with how much they loved the landscape. And so they decided to settle in California. And they started to produce field-grown cut flowers, including chrysanthemums, poinsettias, as well as some gladiolus. And so it was just basically going to be for cut flower production. But it started with the short days of winter inducing these beautiful red bracts. They started to use these as a Christmas plant. And that's really how this association with the poinsettia and Christmas started to be used more in the United States. And they really started to promote the use of poinsettia as the Christmas plant and commercialize it as a horticultural crop.
And about what time period did it begin to be really popular?
It really took off in the 60s. It was used early in the 1900s, but it really became popular. Actually, it was with the advent of television. Albert's grandson, Paul Ecke Jr., was a great promoter of the poinsettia, and he had all sorts of great ideas. And one of them is, let's send a bunch of these beautiful red plants down to the local TV station for free. And so it was great because they got free promotion, and that's really what started to increase the sales of the poinsettia. But it had been used in the early 1900s in the early glasshouses in florist crop production.
All right. And it, as a horticultural crop, I mean, we've talked on this program a number of times about the lengths that people have to go to get these beautiful, vibrant colors from poinsettias. I mean, this is kind of a difficult crop to cultivate.
Yeah. I've got. Do you mind if I could read a passage from an old floriculture textbook?
Sure.
This is great. It's from 1937 by Fritz Barr. Perhaps no other plant or flower we handle during Christmas week is short-lived, wilts quicker, or is more disappointing to those who receive it. Yet, when the next Christmas comes around, there again comes the demand for poinsettias, and the disappointments of a year ago are all forgotten. So it is a challenging crop because you're seeing these beautiful poinsettias in stores now, but we actually start growing them back in July. And so it's a fairly long crop time. That's when we start to take the cuttings and root them and then transplant them and grow them on. And so it's a little bit longer crop compared to like your early spring bedding plants, which might only be a 6-week crop. So it's got a longer production time, and you have to get a couple of things right. They can't get too big. No one wants to have a poinsettia tree on their table. So we have to control the height. We need to get them into flower. A green poinsettia is not worth that much. So we have to make sure that they get those short days to flower. So there's a lot of things that we have to do right in order to produce this crop.
But the payoff is pretty big for people who grow it.
Yeah, it's currently one of the most valuable flowering crops in the United States. It actually recently got dethroned by orchids. Orchids are now the most valuable potted plant per unit, but there is a larger volume sales for poinsettia. It's pretty much the main fall crop for greenhouse producers.
Well, and I can imagine that in a way it really extends the season for greenhouse producers, because you mentioned those annuals. That's all a springtime and summer crop. And this is something that they can continue to use their greenhouses for in the fall.
Exactly. You nailed it. You should come guest lecture in one of my classes.
Well, maybe another time. All right. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking with Chris Curry, Assistant Professor of Horticulture at Iowa State University. Iowa State University Extension Horticulturist Richard Giron is also here. And actually, we're getting a little bit of a preview of some of the music that we'll be listening to as the hour goes on. This is from a CD called Patterns of Plants. And this music was actually inspired by the electrical signals of plants as recorded. I'm a little confused by how it all happened, but it's quite pretty. Anyway, we'll talk more about that in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today. And with me, Iowa State University Extension Horticulturist Richard Giron and Chris Curry, Assistant Professor of Horticulture at Iowa State University. They are here to answer your questions. You can give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. You can call with your questions. We also want to hear about your favorite gardening or yard landscape related gifts that you've received over the years during the holiday season. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. And we do have a question on the line from Nancy in Des Moines. Hi, Nancy.
Hi, good morning.
Hi, what's your question?
I would like your guest to address the paper white narcissus. They don't have the color, but the fragrance is overwhelming. It's delicious. But it seems like while the days are still getting shorter, I can't get my bulbs to bloom. And that leads me to another question about their procreation, because they're a bulb. Do they require insects to come along and help them germinate?
Well, with these, they do not require a cold period. Certain bulbs do like, for example, daffodils, the typical daffodil, the tulip, the hyacinths, they do need a cold period of 10 to 12 weeks. The paper whites do not. So typically, if you buy good quality bulbs and you pot them up, I would just use good potting soil, water them in nicely, and then put them in a cool place for maybe 2 or 3 weeks. The temperature should be around maybe 50 to 60. And that allows the roots to develop, and then move them to a warmer location, maybe 60 to 70. And they should bloom within like maybe 4 or 5 weeks when you do that. So they don't need a cold period per se like tulips and daffodils.
Well, what about the, excuse me, the length of daylight?
That should not be a factor, no. That should be not. Okay. Obviously, when they start to grow, put them in a sunny window. And I would turn them daily so they grow nice and straight. But they do not need a certain day length. No, not at all.
Okay. I've had success in the past years. This year, they're further away from the window.
Okay.
And maybe that they started to flower, and then they just, like, gave up. No.
So maybe check on the quality of the bulbs. If they're not performing well, that would maybe go back to maybe the quality of the bulbs.
Yeah, you can see variation in the quality of bulbs from year to year, and we see that with Easter lilies. Like, I know a year or two ago, the number of flowers that Easter lilies were producing were lower than normal, and that's because the conditions out in Oregon, where a lot of these bulbs are grown in the field, were not... It wasn't a real great growing season, and so they didn't form a lot of flowers. And so these bulbs are produced outside, and then we just force them inside. And so you do have variation year to year.
Okay. All right. That may help explain it.
All right,
okay.
Nancy. Yeah, thanks a lot for your call.
Happy holidays.
You too. 866-780-9100 is the number to call, and Mike is on the line from Milo. Hi, Mike.
Hello. I've got a quick question. I grew up in northern Tanzania mountain range. It's nice and cool up there. And there is a poinsettia growing in my grandma's backyard, which is curious considering that she has no contact with Guatemala or Mexico. So could it be possible it's a similar plant or it's the same plant that somehow is propagated beyond South America?
Oh, that is an excellent question. We didn't get to how the poinsettia has traveled around the rest of the world, and you didn't touch on that in your research, I don't think, to getting it to Tanzania, did you, Chris?
No, but it is around the globe. I know that it is used popularly as a landscape plant around the world. I've seen it in landscapes in Costa Rica, and I've also seen it in the mountains in Thailand. And so it can be used in tropical locations as a landscape plant. And it's gone around the world basically by the same means, cuttings just shipped around the world.
Oh, interesting. So what kind of, I mean, you said tropical, but can you give me an idea of what kind of climate the poinsettia can grow in, the minimum temperature requirements?
I can. The lowest temperature at which a poinsettia will grow is going to be just about between 50 and 55 Fahrenheit. Below that, you'll start to see some cold damage and death. And so usually it's going to be in locations where it doesn't get too much cooler than that, at least not for extended periods of time.
Okay. Does that describe where your grandmother lives, Mike?
Yeah, it does describe. We are in a part of the Kilimanjaro mountain range, and so it's well shaded and it's cool, and so it's shaded by avocado trees and banana trees, so that explains the temperature.
All right, that sounds lovely. And how big is this poinsettia in her yard?
Last I saw it, which was probably 2 years ago, it was about 5 feet. It was a shrub, a pretty good-sized shrub. So
pretty impressive, huh?
Yeah, yes, it was.
All right, Mike, thank you so much for your call.
All right, thank you.
You can join the conversation at 866-780-9100. Chris, how big can poinsettia get to be?
Well, actually, in the wild, in its native habitat, the poinsettia can get up to around 10 feet plus. And
wow.
It normally grows, it's really interesting, the wild poinsettia doesn't branch very freely like the plants that we see. It's normally kind of a spindly little thing that just grows straight up, and it gets these somewhat diminutive red leaves on it, or those bracts. We actually, through selection, you know, trying to pick one point said that's better than the other, and the selection and the breeding process, they found that there's a virus in poinsettias that actually induces branching. And so now what happens is commercial growers, when they have something with nice colored bracts and they need it to get that branching on it, they'll take cuttings and graft it onto a plant that has this branching virus. That branching virus is transmitted to the new plant, and then you can propagate cuttings off of that, and it will have those nice bracts and branch freely. But the wild poinsettia, getting back to your question, it's just kind of a spindly tall thing.
Wow. So all of our poinsettias are sick?
Oh, I don't know about that. They just branch very nicely.
All right. How many different varieties have been developed?
Hundreds and hundreds.
We see, of course, the white ones, the sort of peachy colored ones, the red ones. Is there a limit to the colors that can be created?
I don't think so. Because, well, let me answer that in two parts. One, you start to see some branching out into oranges. They're trying to develop. There's some cultivars called Orange Spice, and they're trying to market these poinsettias as a fall potted plant,
okay.
Halloween, Thanksgiving, as well as, you know, pink poinsettias exist, but now they're starting to develop some more geared towards that Valentine's Day market.
Right.
But the advent of the spray-painted poinsettia it means that we have no limitation on the color of a poinsettia.
Yeah, one of my coworkers told me that she saw a blue one in the store the other day, and she figured somebody was trying to horn in on the Hanukkah market.
Yeah.
And sometimes with sprinkles on them.
Yeah, the glitter.
Glitter.
Yep.
So glitter, that doesn't happen in nature? Are you trying to tell me that's
not exactly
natural?
No.
Okay. You can join our conversation with your questions at 866-780-9100. Don is on the line in Cedar Rapids. Hi, Don.
Hi, good morning. I have a question about a locust tree. In fact, you helped me several years ago determine that I had umbrellas damage on this program, and I have a settlement letter. The question has to do with, when the inspection was made, they gave it a 3 out of 5, which is a 25 to 40% damage, I believe. I paid on my own for treatments this year twice, and so it leafed out better this year. It hadn't done so good the two prior years. The question now is, the damaged branches, and some of those are, you know, only an inch or inch and a half thick, and you can't climb them. How important is it to trim them for the health of the tree? Or is it just, I mean, it looks bad, but is it unhealthy to leave them?
Well, if they're small branches and they're dead, it's not imperative to remove them. It's mainly aesthetic as far as the damage. Eventually, they'll just fall off at some point. We remove bigger branches because if they were to break out, they might damage other branches, but if they're small, they're not going to harm the tree per se when they break out. So I would just leave them.
Okay. The tree has galls all over, but part of the tree regained its growth and looks okay. So the parts that are good look good. The parts that are dead look ugly. But a lot of the branches are small. You can't just climb a tree. You can't just climb a locust like you can an oak.
No, you can't. No, you can't. But I would only prune out those branches that are large. The small ones I would just leave.
Okay, great. Thank you.
All right, Don, thanks a lot for your call. You can join our conversation with your questions at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. It's Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa with me, Chris Curry, Assistant Professor of Horticulture at Iowa State University, and Iowa State University Extension Horticulturist Richard Geron. We'd also love to hear from you if you've received some wonderful gardening-related gifts over the years during the holiday season. Tell us about your favorites, 866-780-9100. And I want to play a little bit of music for you guys right now. So a couple weeks ago, we did a program about some of the best new releases in classical music and folk music of 2014. And Barney Sherman from Iowa Public Radio Classical introduced me to an album. And as I mentioned earlier, we heard just a little bit of a preview of this album. This is from a Japanese composer, and I'm going to try to say the name, but I may say it incorrectly. I apologize. Mamoru Fujieda. And this is from an album called Patterns of Plants. And actually, this composer has done a number of different versions of this, and they're generating melodic material through the micro changes of surface electric potential on leaves. And so apparently all of the different plants have different electric signals. So they're creating different music from all of these different kinds of plants. And sadly, most of the tracks don't actually tell you what plant the music comes from. But this one that I'm just about to play does, and it's a flower. So I want you guys to listen and try to guess what flower inspired this song. All right, here we go. That's just a little bit from the album Patterns of Plants. Do you have a guess, Richard?
I'm going to say chrysanthemum.
Oh, that's a good guess. What do you think, Chris?
Orchids?
It is the begonia. Of course.
Not even close.
Well, you know. It was really an impossible task. But it's really fun music. It's just too bad from my perspective that we can't tell what plants inspired all of the different tracks, but we'll play out of the segment with another one of the tracks here in just a couple of minutes. You are welcome to join our conversation at 866-780-9100. Tweet us at IPR Talk or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Mike is on the line in Dubuque. Hi, Mike.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. What's your question?
2 hours and 30 minutes of remaining.
I have a couple of arborvitas that have been winter burnt, and then the rabbits got to the bottom of them. So the tops of the trees are still growing, and they have new sprouts, but the bottom of the tree is practically dead. And is there anything I can do about that, or is it just basically let it grow out?
Well, unfortunately, with evergreens, once they lose that green portion, they don't develop new growth in that area. So that area is always going to be unsightly. That's unfortunate. You see that quite a bit where the deer just love arborvitae. And they will devour what they can reach. And unfortunately, when they do that, that area does not grow back. So it's going to be kind of unsightly for basically the rest of the life of that plant.
All right. Because I just started now wrapping chicken wire around the bottom. Mm-hmm. And it's kept the rabbits from them. And I'm just hoping maybe once the tree gets bigger that the space at the bottom won't be so noticeable.
Well, some of that growth above it may hang down a little bit, but for the most part, it's always going to be there, unfortunately.
So should he trim it back so that it just looks a little neater? Or?
Well, I'm not sure. What they might consider possibly doing is putting something in front of it to maybe hide it. Maybe something a little bit shorter in size that would kind of hide that bottom portion of the evergreens, maybe a smaller shrub in front of it so you don't see the ugly part.
Because they're the Groot Spire, I guess, breed, and the eaten section or the burnt section is only about 2 foot tall right now.
Okay. So
that's why I was hoping they get about 10 foot tall. Maybe if that doesn't travel with the tree, it'd look okay.
Okay. There are some smaller roundish arborvitae that might look kind of nice in front of that, and they only get 2 or 3 feet tall, so that might work, possibly.
Okay.
All right, Mike, thanks a lot for your call.
And thank you.
And so far, it's been a much kinder winter to arborvitae.
Yes, it has.
We'll see how things turn out.
But it's only December,
right.
So.
David is on the line next in Illinois. Hi, David.
Hi, good morning.
Hi, what's your question?
I have what was a dwarf lilac planted on my property that has gotten ungainly, and I'd like to trim it back. Not sure if I can hard prune it to force it into a smaller bush again, or what should I do?
When you say gangly, too big or just misshapen?
It's gotten way too large. It was supposedly a 8 to 10 foot max growth, but it's probably 15 feet tall at this point.
Okay. Yeah, the common lilac is not a small shrub. It can get to be 12 to 15 feet tall. What I would be inclined to do is maybe go out in March and maybe select maybe 3, 4, 5 of the largest, oldest stems and cut those back near the ground. And that will reduce the size of the plant quite a bit by doing that. You'll still have some additional branches there to bloom. And then the following year, I'd go out again, probably in March, maybe take out another two or three of the largest ones and kind of bring back the size a little bit, but still keep the plant blooming.
All right, David.
One of the things that we do like about it the most is the smell in the spring. So
okay.
I'd like to keep it, but the size is just way
too small. Yeah, they're hard to kill, so that shouldn't be an issue. Just basically prune it back periodically, and like I said, just take out some of the older growth on a periodic basis. That way you can reduce the size quite a bit.
Great. We'll give it a shot.
All right, David, thanks a lot. And if you take out some of the growth, does that impact the number of blooms you'll have in the spring?
Absolutely. You'll have fewer, but you'll still have some of the wood there that will bloom, so it's not going to be without any flowers at all. But if you do that periodically, you can keep the plant a little bit smaller in size, healthy and vigorous.
All right. David, thank you so much for your call. You can join our conversation, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. It's Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa. With me, Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Giron. Chris Curry, Assistant Professor of Horticulture at Iowa State University, is also here. And we've got a couple lines open for you right now, so it's a great time to get in with your questions. 866-780-9100 is the number to call, and we will go to the break with a little more from the album Patterns of Plants. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today. With me, Chris Curry, Assistant Professor of Horticulture at Iowa State University, and Iowa State University Extension Horticulturist Richard Giron, the final Horticulture Day of 2014. You're welcome to join the conversation with your questions at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Evelyn is on the line from Kelowna. Hi, Evelyn.
Hello.
Hi, what's your question?
We have a couple rows of evergreens, and last winter was so harsh on them. The one in the middle, of course, got a lot of brown branches on it. There is some green interspersed, and at the top there's green. But would it just be better to just take the whole tree out?
Well, it kind of depends upon the extent. If, let's say, more than 50% is brown, I don't think saving it is a very good option, just because recovery, having that plant look nice again, I don't think it's likely. So if it's a high percent that's brown, I would be inclined to remove it. If it's only 10 or 20% brown, I'd cut out the brown.
All right.
You just cut out the brown and see what's left?
Right. If it's only like 10 or 20%, I would just cut out the brown and leave the rest and see if that plant can recover. But if, let's say, 60% or 70% is brown, that plant is not going to recover, and I would remove it.
Yeah. Okay. That's what I was afraid of. Okay.
You're not alone, Evelyn, if that makes you feel better. A lot of people have had to go through this in the last year.
Yeah. Okay.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call.
Mm-hmm. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Join the conversation at 866-780-9100. Heidi is on the line in LeClaire. Hi, Heidi.
Hi. Can you hear me okay?
Yep. What's your question?
Oh, okay. Thanks for taking my call, and I love your show. You're quite the educator.
Oh, thank you.
I have a very small poinsettia that I have kept over winter and put it in the dark for 13 hours a night. And finally, there are two tiny, tiny, maybe half-inch leaf racks, I guess you call them, that have turned red. And I wondered if now is the time to leave it out and not put it in the dark.
Yeah, so what happened is you've induced the flowering. And so now that the flowering has occurred, you can take it out and you don't need to keep giving it that dark treatment, and it will keep those red leaves. So yeah, the flowering is underway, and you can take it on out and enjoy it.
Oh, great. And just one extra. It doesn't take a lot of water, right? It's just a little water when it gets dry on the first top soil.
Poinsettias are generally pretty good about telling you when they need watering, because their leaves will droop, or I call it flagging. They'll usually show when they need some water.
Okay, so some of these leaves have just kind of dropped off, but I guess that's a natural process.
Yeah, and actually that's part of the challenge with the poinsettia. And going back to that earlier quote, those showy bracts and leaves, when they first started to ship poinsettias, they would all drop off during shipping, and so you'd pull out these containers with a stick coming out of the pot. So
Christmas magic for you?
Yeah.
Well, I've got enough green leaves that I'm not too worried. So thank you very much.
All right,
Heidi.
Merry
Christmas.
Yeah, thank you. Happy holidays to you, too. And Chris, you read that passage. I sense that poinsettias have become a little more hardy over the years.
Absolutely. Because they're such an important floriculture crop, there's been a lot of efforts into the breeding and increasing that post-harvest quality. And they've done a real fine job of doing that now, where poinsettias are fairly robust, nothing like what they used to be like. I've talked to people who had worked with those older varieties, and they say it's just night and day, the old cultivars versus these newer cultivars. So the poinsettias really come a long way.
All right. You can join our conversation with your questions at 866-780-9100. Tweet us at IPR Talk or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Norma is on the line. And Carol, hi, Norma.
Hi. I was just wondering, I was going to save some pumpkin seed, but the pumpkin is frozen. And if I thaw that out, will the seed still be okay?
Yeah, the seed should be fine. Just bring it inside, let it thaw out, remove the seed, wash the seed. Let the seed dry for a few days, like on a screen or something, a paper plate. And then once the seed is dry, I would put the seed in a packet and store the seed in a cool, dry place. Should be fine.
Okay, very good. So in general, any vegetable or flower, if they've frozen, they'd still be okay to save?
Yeah, typically it doesn't. The actual cold temperature does not affect their viability. So that shouldn't be a problem. If you leave it out long enough, what's going to happen is you'll have the moisture and the cold temperatures, and together, eventually, the seed will rot. But at this point, I think the seed should be fine.
Okay, very good. Thank you.
All right, Norma, thanks a lot for your call. 866-780-9100 is the number to call with your question. We've got a couple lines open and some time for a few more calls this hour. 866-780-9100. Here is an email question from Brad in Pella. I have bought Venus flytraps on a number of occasions. I'm able to keep them alive for a little while, but not long term. What am I missing?
Well, I would ask Brad what he's using to water his plants, because one of the most important things with carnivorous plants, including the Venus flytrap, a butterwort, or a sundew, is to use very, very high-quality water. So usually spring or distilled water from the grocery store in those gallon jugs is what is recommended to use with carnivorous plants. A lot of times if you're using tap water, there's a lot of other stuff in the water that's not going to be conducive to growing those plants. So a lot of times that can be related to water quality.
And do not try to force feed the plant with a hamburger or meat. That's not a good thing.
Isn't that why you get them?
Well, but hamburger meat, that really doesn't work. They don't actually have to eat flies or other insects. They just do that to supplement their diet, so it's not necessary. But they definitely don't want hamburger or meat, per se.
Okay. All right. I think that's part of the fun of getting them, is the idea that you can feed them something like that, though, right?
Well, if you caught some flies, you could do that, but not hamburger.
Okay. Noted.
Hot dog, whatever.
I hope Brad's listening. All right. Charlie is on the line next in East Moline. Hi, Charlie.
Hello.
Hi. What's your question?
I have an ornamental elm that I think is a tree and shouldn't be really trimmed back much, and I have people that cut my grass because I live in a condo, and they want to treat it as a bush. And periodically, I have kind of a fight when they want to trim it way back. It's up to maybe about 6.5 feet and in good shape. Sometimes when it's really dry, I have to cut out some of the dead stuff.
Okay. Now, the elm typically is a large tree. There are various species, various varieties, but I don't know of any that would be a shrub.
No.
So are you sure it's an elm?
Yeah, they always told us it was the Chinese ornamental elm.
Okay. Now, there is a Chinese elm that has very attractive bark, mottled bark, peeling bark. But that is a tree that typically gets to be like 30, 40, 50 feet tall. So,
ours is not any, doesn't look like that.
Okay.
That you just described.
Okay.
It's almost like a shrub, but it has really big leaves, almost like a maple.
Okay. Does it have lobed leaves, or are they pretty simple?
They're kind of lobed.
Okay. Well, it doesn't sound like an elm to me, because
okay.
Elms typically don't have lobed leaves. Now, what you could do next year when it has foliage is to take some photographs, digital photographs, and send those to Iowa State. You can send those to the Hort Line, which is HORTLINE at iastate.edu. Does this plant flower at all?
No, never does.
Never does.
Just has leaves that kind of turn dark reddish, and it thrives, but then they eventually drop off late November.
Okay. So no distinctive flower or fruit, just a foliage plant.
Yep.
Okay. I'm not sure at this point. That would be my suggestion. Wait till it leaves out next year and send us some photographs. I'm sure we can identify it.
Okay. Thank you.
All right, Charlie, thanks a lot for your call. 866-780-9100 is the number to call with your questions. 866-780-9100. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And this is an email from Catherine in Marion. I know that amaryllis bulbs are supposed to be foolproof, but I have failed to get an amaryllis to bloom. What's the secret?
Well, if you buy one and you pot it up and it doesn't bloom, I would say you bought a poor quality bulb.
Okay.
Because they're ready to go, and if it's a good quality bulb, it's almost foolproof. They should go ahead and bloom. Now, once you have them, getting them to bloom again can be rather tricky. But when you buy one, it should bloom if it's a good quality bulb.
So, and with amaryllis bulbs, we've talked about this before, you kind of suggest not investing the time and energy to get them to bloom again?
Oh, I think it's worth it if you want to. It's not that difficult. You basically, it's only going to bloom once a year, though. So
right. You
have to care for it the rest of the year. It's really not that tricky. It basically is treated as a house plant through the winter, and then you can bring it outside in the spring, and then you bring it back in late summer. And then in the fall, for it to bloom, the plant needs to be exposed to temperatures of 50 to 55 degrees for basically 8 to 10 weeks. Those temperatures initiate flower development. If they don't get that, they don't bloom. So that's the tricky part.
Is there a payoff from keeping it from year to year? Do the blooms get bigger?
Well, right. If the bulb gets bigger, you might get two flower stalks.
Okay.
Which is really nice. And on occasion, they do produce daughter bulbs, so you have side bulbs. So you may end up actually with more plants.
And if you ignore your amaryllis, I'll go ahead and admit this is from experience. You ignore it long enough, you end up with a seed pod. Can you plant those seeds?
You can, but they're not going to be identical to the parent. And it's probably going to take maybe, I would guess, 3 or 4 years before that bulb gets big enough to bloom. So
okay. So that's a real investment
yes,
of time.
Yes, it is.
But it's okay if you want to treat it as a disposable
yes,
organic it, item. You can put
you
that in
can,
the compost
you can
and
compost
move on.
It, yes.
All right. Well, and with so many of the plants, obviously some people can keep their poinsettia from year to year. A lot of people also compost those. Chris, do you try to keep yours from year to year?
No, I do not. I like to support the greenhouse industry.
All right, so we need to take into account that it is a horticultural crop, and we're supporting farmers.
I think, the poinsettia that you can get yourself by reblooming it is going to look drastically different than the poinsettia that comes out of that greenhouse that you're purchasing.
Really?
Yeah, because there's a lot of there's a lot of stuff, as we were talking about earlier, that greenhouse growers need to do to get that real nice-looking poinsettia, and it can be difficult to achieve that in a home environment. But not all crops are like that. Like the Thanksgiving and Christmas cactus, that can be a great plant that you can rebloom year after year, again, with that those short days, and it can look just as good or pretty close to that greenhouse-grown plant. But the poinsettia can be a real tricky one to try and pull off. But I do applaud those who tried, and especially that caller who called in earlier with that success. That's great to hear.
Yeah. This is a question from John. He says, you were talking a few weeks ago and mentioned what you can do to speed up the composting process in your compost pile, and an accelerant was mentioned. What was it?
I don't recall that. The main thing there would be to keep it moist and to turn it often. Those are the two main things. And when you're actually adding plant material, do add layers of soil and possibly some fertilizer, because the soil contains the microbes that are going to break down the compost. So add those and just turn it often and keep it moist.
All right. Any specific kind of fertilizer?
I would just use like an all-purpose fertilizer, like a 10-10-10.
All right. And this one's a long shot email from John in Winona, Minnesota. He said he's now seeing essential oils in healthcare. Are there Iowa native plants that could be useful in creating essential oils? I realize that's not either one of your area of expertise. We can skip that one and find somebody else to answer that question.
I'm not sure if I can answer that. I don't think
okay.
I can.
All right. So we have just a couple of minutes left, and a lot of people around the holidays like to take a plant with them to give to a host or hostess, that kind of thing. We've talked about not keeping the poinsettias long term. Christmas cactus is something that lasts. The amaryllis bulbs will give you a beautiful bloom, but a lot of people don't keep them from year to year. What are some plants that make nice gifts that can be kept?
I like orchids. Because they don't require that much care, and they're pretty easy to grow. So I would say that. I would say maybe the Norfolk Island pine, which is kind of nice. I like cyclamens. You'll find those right now. And if they have good care, they'll bloom for probably 6, 7, 8 weeks, which is kind of nice. So those are some of the plants that I would consider.
All right, Chris, any to add?
Well, I'd like to second Richard's suggestion about the cyclamen. I think it's a great plant. I think it lasts a long time in the home, and it's fairly bulletproof. I would also like to give a shout-out to Streptocarpus. It's not a sickness or a cold that's going around. It's a wonderful relative of the African violet. I think it's a great plant that you can grow on for years, and you can divide it. It's a wonderful house plant that is you don't see it too much anymore.
All right. And what does it look like?
It's another word for it is the Cape violet, and it'll have these kind of long leaves that'll be soft like an African violet, and then it has flowers that come up from the center of the plant. They don't really look like an African violet. They look almost like a catalpa flower. I don't want to say orchid-like, but they're pretty showy, and they're a great plant. And they used to be more popular, and they've kind of declined in popularity. So go to your local florist and ask for some Streptocarpus.
All right. Well, and speaking of bulletproof plants, we just had a holiday celebration over the weekend, and we were reflecting on the fact that everyone in my family still has a healthy, happy philodendron plant that came from a cutting from a plant from my grandma's house, and she died, I think, 17 years ago. So that's a plant that's
right.
Hard to kill. Not that we're trying. Thank you both so much for being here today.
You're welcome.
Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Geron and Chris Curry, thank you.
Thank you.
Chris Curry, assistant professor of horticulture at Iowa State University. We'll be back with another Horticulture Day coming up on January 9th. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury, and Claire Roth. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Charity Nebbe. Happy holidays. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.